Hello, writing students, writing teachers, and writing activists. I'm Grant Faulkner, Executive Director of National Novel Writing Month, and today we have a very special guest, Kate Schatz, who is many, many things. She taught NaNoWriMo at Oakland School for the Arts for years, and then she published a book that has turned into not just a bestseller, but a kind of phenomena, Rad American Women A to Z, which has spawned several follow-up books as well. And I'm with my rad and radical co-host, Brooke Warner. And Brooke, since I originally met Kate as a teacher of NaNoWriMo, I've been thinking about my own writing education, or I might say my non-education in writing. I only remember being taught grammar, not true expressive writing. So I think I essentially taught myself how to write, largely through reading and imitating others, which I still do, actually. I wondered how you learned to write, because I hear so many adults say they didn't like it as a subject growing up, and I think that's a shame. Did you have inspiring writing teachers who let you write fanciful stories in the classroom, or did you have strict grammarians with red pencils, or did you largely teach yourself like me, or all the above and something else?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question because I've never really thought about that before. But you're right that we certainly didn't learn. I mean, I think maybe our generation or just where we grew up didn't learn how to write in public school, you know, unless you're lucky enough to have a special teacher who takes it upon themselves to prioritize that, which Kate talks about in our interview today that she did, which is so awesome. I actually had a close friend in elementary school who was a poet, you know, one of those just super creative souls who turned me on to writing stories and understanding that writing could actually be a thing that kids did as a hobby. So that was pretty cool. But I kind of just followed and imitated her. It didn't really take root for me. And then I had the opposite experience of Kate when I was in high school with my senior year AP literature teacher, who was actually pretty actively discouraging and critical of my creative writing. And that had a pretty long lasting impact for me. So in my case, I went into book publishing and I guess I learned how to write from editing other people's work for sure. And kind of learning how to write on the job. So that's probably where I would give the most credit, which of course didn't start until my 20s. So I'd love to hear the story though, Grant, of how you taught yourself to write. How did that go?
Yeah, I don't remember any particularly creative writing exercises in the classroom until high school at the earliest, and not really much then. I think one misconception about teaching writing, even now sometimes, is that it's mostly about the mechanics, knowing the rules of grammar, as if once you know where to put a comma and start a paragraph with a topic sentence, you've mastered it. I remember sitting and watching the teacher diagram sentences on the chalkboard, and probably the whole class was tuned out. And I can remember carrying my boring grammar book home from school, but I don't remember ever learning how language could be meaningful and fun and expressive, how it could lead places within myself and the world. I remember enjoying writing, you know, like history reports and research papers because I was a studious kid, but I think I also just copied a lot from encyclopedias. So, I mean, I think that was a form of instruction, but I don't think that that was necessarily writing. So fortunately, I was a reader and I liked writing. So I think I learned just by osmosis almost without knowing it. And I actually remember the day I read a novel in high school that had a lot of dashes. And I didn't know that there were rules. I don't even know if I knew what a dash was. I certainly didn't know there were rules about how to use dashes, but I just started using them and learned how they worked in a sentence by feel. And all of my writing until college was really by feel. And even into my 20s, like you say, I think I learned really late. And as a result, I've always felt somewhat insecure about my knowledge of language and grammar, even when I taught composition in community college, or maybe because I taught composition, because that put a lot of pressure on me to be an expert and put me on the spot. And this is all to say, this is why I'm so happy about our Young Writers Program and that 100,000 kids get to write novels every year, because that wasn't available to me. So I couldn't even imagine writing a novel. And here's one more important thing I observe is that kids are more likely to learn things like grammar when they're having fun and playing with words and when what they're writing has personal meaning and purpose to them. That's one reason why I think our program is so effective. I was lacking a bigger context of writing that was personal and purposeful to me. And I think having that context is what makes the rules of grammar more meaningful and more interesting to learn. You want to like perfect that craft. So I'm grateful that my kids' writing education has been vastly better than mine, because I think the education field has improved so much in my lifetime. Do you notice that with your son, James?
Yeah, it's interesting if the education has improved. I mean, that might be the case. I also think I just feel lucky. I think this district, living in Berkeley, we have a pretty a certain kind of emphasis on things that I just didn't experience where I was growing up in Southern California. James has been lucky in that last year in third grade, he had a teacher who prioritized writing. And I went and observed in the classroom once a week during, observed slash helped during writing time. And I was super impressed with the breadth of the projects she was having them work on, like dipping into every genre and learning how to actually tell story. And I either don't remember that in elementary school or I just didn't learn it either way. You know, so generally I just have been impressed up until now, of course, because I do think the pandemic has squashed that in the sense that the kids don't have the interaction with their teachers in the way that they have when it's one-on-one. And James recently said in a parent-teacher conference that he doesn't like to write. Hmm. And that was news to me and a little heartbreaking. And I do think that it's about this year. And I just want to say this for fellow parents and grandparents out there, you know, that the kids are discouraged, but I think that they're going to come back. You know, I have faith that, you know, this year is maybe not really the best year, but next year we're going to resurrect James's love for writing and by extension school, I hope.
Yeah, it's definitely an unfortunate year and every child is reacting differently to the method and the whatever, the environment of instruction. And I can't imagine, it must be really painful to hear a statement like that and not have a quick remedy because there's just not one available. Pre-pandemic, I would have killed for my kids' teachers and their curriculum. I mean, they got to write poems and stories and plays from early on. And, you know, I do see it as an evolution of writing education because I think writing education is more inventive these days. And I do think it places the student more at the center of things and their expression and their personal expression. But that said, there is a lot of pressure, I know, to emphasize nonfiction or academic writing at the expense of fiction in the classroom, because nonfiction is, I think some people view it as supposedly about, you know, more about real knowledge. And it's so that makes it more relevant to the world. But I'd actually argue that the kind of imagination and expression and love of language and playfulness that fiction can spark is just as relevant to the world. And once you have that, that actually helps you tell your nonfiction stories better. And in fact, I recently read, I love this statistic, 75% of scientists became scientists, they say, because they loved reading science fiction as kids. Hmm. And so stories were their imaginative gateways, in other words, in a way that books on hard science might not have been.
That's so cool. What a great statistic.
I love it.
Yeah. And I also want to note that Kate's illustrator for Rad American Women A to Z was, I think still is, a teacher at Berkeley High. Mm-hmm. And when my stepsons were at Berkeley High, I knew her a bit and I would see her around, especially like at art shows and stuff like that. And so I know that Kate also wrote this book in part for her daughter because she felt that there was a gap in children's book on this topic. So I love the education connection, the Berkeley connection, and the Rad Women connection. So it's quite a trifecta.
Yeah, I'm glad Kate wrote the book because my daughter actually read it. I remember when she read it when I got the book, and I loved how she'd tell me about different radical women and their stories and what they'd done in the world. And I read it as well. So I don't think of it as a children's book. In fact, it's brief and accessible and super informative, but that makes it great to read in one setting. And the illustrations, as you mentioned, are just, I think, a big part of the book's success and meaning. They're so compelling.
Yeah, so I'm excited to hear more about her and the story and radical women and radical living in general, which we'll do right after this break.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I'm thrilled to introduce our guest today, Kate Schatz, who is a New York Times bestselling author of Rad American Women A to Z and Rad Women Worldwide, as well as My Rad Life, a journal, and Rid of Me, a story, a novel. She is the former chair of the School of Literary Arts at Oakland School for the Arts, where she taught fiction, poetry, and journalism to 9th through 12th graders for many years. And she taught NaNoWriMo, which is how I first met her. She also has the very interesting distinction of being in charge of Conan O'Brien's Whiteness, which I hope to hear more about today. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you. Hello.
Well, I first heard about you as a wonderful NaNoWriMo teacher in the Bay Area who happened to also be the author of this great and very popular book, Rad American Women, A to Z. We actually haven't had an NaNoWriMo teacher on the show, so I'd love for you to talk about teaching kids creative writing and why it's important in this current educational climate that, you know, actually often discourages creative writing in favor of nonfiction writing or academic writing. And then what did you find beneficial about the framework of NaNoWriMo for young writers?
Oh, yeah. Getting the good questions off the bat. I love it. You know, when you just said that, I just had a memory of when I remember the first time that I was teaching NaNoWriMo at Oakland School for the Arts. I had actually set up a visit. And Grant, I don't know if it was you or someone else from NaNoWriMo was all set to come and do a special visit with my students. And I remember that when that person arrived, we had a massive unexpected fire alarm go off in the building and everybody had to evacuate. And we missed that visit. So,
We owe you one.
That's my memory. I taught NaNoWriMo. I had done it myself, just, you know, because it was fun and I wanted to try it. And then when I was teaching creative writing to the high school students, I thought, wow, this would be really great to do with them. And I did it for years and I loved it. And I think, you know, when I think about the importance of teaching creative writing in schools, I mean, it's really personal for me because in many ways I attribute a lot of my career as a writer to an English teacher that I had in 11th grade, who was the first person, the first teacher I ever had who actually gave a creative writing assignment in class, and then who also was really encouraging for me. So I had loved writing ever since I was a kid, and I did get to do some creative writing in elementary school, which is where I really like realized how much I loved writing. And then once I hit middle school and high school, that just disappeared completely. And I really remember being a junior in high school and we did this creative writing unit and I wrote a short story for the first time and I turned it in and it was an actual assignment. And I was so happy. And I had this wonderful teacher who was a writer himself. And he pulled me aside one day and did that, like, it was like an after school special. You know, he totally did the, like, you're a great writer. You could major in this in college. Have you ever thought about doing this for your career? And I was like totally stunned. And I didn't even know you could major in creative writing in college. Like I had no model for what a path could look like to be a writer. And he was really the person who showed me that. So that's, you know, I mean, aside from all of my other strong opinions about why creativity in schools and expression in arts matters, which I could talk about forever, but I actually have this really personal connection to like what that meant to me. Mm. And through my work at Oakland School for the Arts in particular, and through working in other creative writing programs with young people, you know, I've just really seen what it can do for young people when they get this chance to express themselves in a different way and, you know, get to learn how to articulate their thoughts and just be creative.
Yeah, you're so lucky, Kate, because so many people have the opposite experience. And so good for you for then turning that experience and putting it out into the world in that way. It's so awesome. I know that you're also a fiction writer and you graduated from Brown's MFA program. So you obviously followed that advice, which is really great. And then you published a novel, PJ Harvey's Rid of Me. And after that, this children's book, Rad American Women A to Z, but I don't necessarily think of it as a children's book. Certainly not only for kids. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about this publishing journey and what it's meant to switch to a new genre and then have unexpected success.
Oh, goodness. Yes. You know, it's true. I was really, fiction writing was my thing. I was really focused on, you know, literary fiction and really kind of experimental literary fiction. And my book, Rid of Me, was, you know, it was like this queer dystopic fairy tale. And then the next book I published was a nonfiction historical children's book. So yeah, I really switched gears. And, you know, in part, I didn't think much about what it would mean to shift genres like that, you know, and when I talk about this, I often talk about just, you know, storytelling is storytelling. And I feel like the tools I use in the nonfiction that I write and all of the Rad Women books that I've done now, I feel like I'm using the same kind of craft tools that I developed as a fiction writer that I honed at my MFA program. And over the years, you know, I'm still trying to, you know, even though what I'm doing is nonfiction and it's rooted in historical fact, I'm still working super hard to engage readers and to, you know, to hook them in and to, and in a way I feel like I'm working harder because I'm trying to make kind of obscure histories interesting to a wide audience, you know, and when it comes to kind of unexpectedly finding success with it, that was a real interesting experience. I was really rooted in the kind of small press indie publishing world. And I just as when I was younger, I didn't have a model for what it looked like to become a writer. Then I kind of figured that out. I definitely did not have a model of what it could look like to be a writer who made money, mm-hmm. Like at all. And I had incredibly small expectations. And even for Rad American Women A to Z, we published it with City Lights. Our first print run was, you know, was 5,000 copies. And I was like blown away that I had actually written a book that was going to have that many copies in the world. And I had incredibly small expectations for it. And then that first print run sold out before Pub Day. And it became this kind of unexpected viral success. And it was, it was a real trip, to say the least, to realize that this was actually going to turn into something much bigger than what we anticipated.
Kate, I think that's so interesting about how you said that your storytelling fiction skills enhanced your essentially more nonfiction writing or even academic writing. That's always the case I make for it when I hear that kids should be writing research papers instead of novels. I think they go together and complement each other really well. And I'm interested in how constraints can enliven our imagination and actually make us kind of more, ironically, more creative, and which is one reason I think the A to Z format is so interesting. I imagine it, you know, that kind of format or that limitation of one person for each letter perhaps made you, you know, make some really interesting choices about who to feature for each letter and how the whole book went together. Were there any surprising discoveries or women you didn't know much about beforehand?
Oh, completely. And, you know, constraints are, that's like my favorite thing to talk about, creative writing constraints. I love it. I think that I'm someone who at this point, I almost like require that for, and I think I always have, like, I've always loved prompts, like really specific, strange prompts. And when I teach creative writing, I mean, that's the kind of stuff I love. And I actually think that's why NaNoWriMo always appealed to me, because it is a constraint, you know? I mean, and constraints, they're totally arbitrary, right? Like, why November? Why, like, why 50,000 words? Like, what, yeah. You know? But like, that kind of stuff really, like, I love structure. I love deadlines. And I think, you know, deadlines are another kind of constraint. You know, sometimes I'll ask my editor to give me like fake deadlines. Like, she's like, I don't need this for a while. And I'm like, can you just pretend that Friday's the deadline? but I feel like, you know, and it's funny. I have a son who's in second grade and he's struggling with writing a lot right now. And his teacher, bless her heart, she keeps giving them these open-ended prompts for their writing. And the assignment is like, write a story about anything you want. And I know from my own experience teaching that at one point I thought that was great. Like, you think you're giving your students tons of freedom, but it can actually really paralyze a lot of people who feel overwhelmed by what am I going to write about? And I think I've always felt that way. And I learned that as a teacher, that the more constraints I gave students, the more weirdly specific the prompts were or the assignments, the more that they could feel like they could get started and then create something really unexpected. And I think, I'm sure there are lots of people who would love the assignment of write literally anything you want. But I have found that you get much better results, both creatively and just in terms of like efficiency, when there's some kind of constraint or structure to the assignment. And, you know, and that, you know, doing an A to Z book, like, cool, I'm going to write about women from history. There's like thousands and millions. So using the constraint of A to Z was just great. It definitely helped me narrow it down. When we did Rad Women Worldwide, that was, we decided right away that that was not going to be an A to Z book, in part because we wanted to include more women than just 26, but also because the English alphabet is not the alphabet of the entire world. We wanted the book to feel more global. And I'm really glad because the book's now been translated into a number of languages. And so we knew that the A to Z wouldn't work in translation necessarily. So we had to kind of invent another constraint. So we decided that 50 or no, 40. There's 40 stories in that one. And I'm trying to remember how we actually decided that, but I remember struggling. I remember struggling without the A to Z constraint. So for our most recent book, Rad American History A to Z, we did return to the A to Z format, and I felt a great relief upon doing that.
Hmm. Well, Grant and I have talked a lot on this show about how writing and believing in yourself as a creator enlivens your sense of self in many ways. And sometimes people think that writing is a retreat from the world, right? Because it's solitary. And so I'm wondering about that for you. Like, what are your thoughts about the connection between creativity and being an active agent or change, you know, or even radical change in the world?
Oh, yeah. I'd say... I am an extrovert and I'm a really community-oriented person. So for me, my activism and my connection with community and my desire to engage with the world has always been part of my writing process. I like my solo writing time, but I can't have just that. so I feel like that's always been really central to my creative process. And definitely with the Rad Women books and the book I'm working on now, engaging community, engaging people and collaborating is just a huge part of how I like to work. You know, I've done all of the Rad Women books I've done in collaboration with the illustrator, Miriam Kleinstahl, and who's also an activist. And I think we're both people who just from the earliest days of our, you know, our work, there's not been a separation for me or for her between activism and art and creation. Those things have always just overlapped very naturally for me and for her. I'll say that I have in addition to the books I've been publishing the last few years, like so many of us, I have a novel that I've just been dragging around for years trying to finish. And I think a big part of why it's taken me so long to finish that is because it's not a collaborative project. It's just me. Mm. It's just me and all my goddamn ideas sitting by myself. And I work much better when I'm in some kind of partnership. You know, even though I'm ultimately the one doing all of the writing in my books, I'm always working with a lot of people, whether it's like crowdsourcing ideas or interviewing people for research. That's the way that I like to work.
Hmm. I mean, okay, since you mentioned that interesting overlap between activism and creativity, I'm curious, if you wrote a book of Rad American Women authors A to Z, who would be a few of the authors you might include and why?
Oh my goodness. Well, I think A would be so hard. I mean, just to start, you know, it's like, is it A is for Audre Lorde or is A for Adrienne Rich? Like that, I probably just get stuck there. You know what I'm staring at? I mean, I think O's easy. O would be Octavia Butler.
Yeah.
You know, well, Z would be Zora Neale Hurston. That's what it is in Rad American A to Z.
We're on our way to a book proposal now.
I mean, I could literally take you through the alphabet, completely right now. You know, I'm actually staring at all of my books that are in my wall. So yeah, those would be some. I think L would probably be Lucille Clifton, maybe. You know, I guess T would be Toni Morrison and E would probably be Eileen Miles. You know, I'm really, this is a fun question to ask me.
Most people are so caught off guard by this kind of question. I love that you're just like, I got this.
Yeah. Miriam, my collaborator, always jokes that when we first sat down to work on Rad American Women A to Z together, I'd been working on the idea for a while and I had a big spreadsheet of my ideas. And she looked at it and she's like, most of these people are writers. We need to really mix this up. And I was like, oh gosh, they are, aren't they? So...
Well, it makes sense, right? And I mean, you're a writer, but you also work so hard at being an activist, and you're the co-founder of Solitary Sundays, which is a nationwide network of feminist activist groups. And I imagine that takes a lot of time. So how do you balance your writing and your activism, or do you view them as fulfilling the same purpose?
That's a great question. And one way that I balance that is that I no longer run Solidarity Sundays because it was taking up too much time. Mm. No, like I said, I think that that work has always just been, it's been what I do. It's been what I've been doing for a long time. You know, I think that because writing is my full-time job and kind of public speaking and events and writing is what is my income now, that I have had to make some choices around that. So with Solidarity Sundays, which is a group I started several years ago, that grew to a beautiful, thriving organization and community that I got to a point where I just couldn't be, I wasn't in a place to be running like a full-on nonprofit organization. So I was really happy that there were some other people who stepped up and kind of and took it over and continued to run it. And that's actually been wildly satisfying to me, to kind of start something, watch it grow, and then be able to step away. So maybe that's one of the answers, is the way I balance it is knowing when I need to, when I can step away from something or say no to something. And also, you know, I think that my activism has shifted over the years. And I think that's something I talk about a lot with people, that, you know, the activism you did in your 20s might look different when you're in your 40s and have kids and a full-time job, you know, and it can look like a lot of different things. So, you know, and even if it's like a lot of social media based activism, that can still be, you know, important and powerful. So I've done a lot of things over the years, and what I also feel is, for me, realizing that my writing is one of my most effective forms of activism. So focusing mostly on that is not, you know, I try not to feel bad about not going out to organizing meetings as much, because I'm home focusing on my books, because that's, I think, quite an effective form of activism these days.
Well, Kate, in closing, I guess this is a different type of activism. It's the kind of activism in the comedy world. And in 2020, our local great comedian, Kamau Bell, charged you with being in charge of Conan O'Brien's whiteness. And then you later went on Conan's show to guide him. It was one of my favorite episodes, I think, that I've ever seen on any kind of talk show. And you obviously weren't just a regular guest, but it was super fun and super informative. And just for listeners, Google it on YouTube. You can watch it in its entirety. And I was wondering if you can tell us how this whole story transpired.
Yeah. You know, again, I guess maybe related to what I said before, what I was just saying about, you know, following the course of life and activism and how things can happen unexpectedly. In the wake of the murder of George Floyd, you know, earlier this year, Kamau Bell, who's a comedian, a TV show host, and a good friend of mine, and he is an African-American man, and he was getting a lot of the questions that a lot of Black folks were getting, which is white people coming to him saying, what can I do? How do I make a difference? What do I do? And so he had kind of jokingly but seriously sent me a text about this and was like, can you help me with these white people? What do I tell them? And I said, yes, Kamau, send me the white people. Just, you don't need to deal with them. Just send them my way. And then like the next day he texted me and was like, I'm going on Conan O'Brien in 10 minutes. Can you call me? I need your advice. So I pulled over and called him, and we kind of brainstormed, like, you know, he's got X amount of time on Conan to really talk about race and anti-racism and what white people could do, what's going to be effective to say. And then, you know, kind of as a joke, he told Conan, he said, look, Conan, I can't take on all of this. My friend Kate Schatz is a white lady. She's going to be in charge of your whiteness now. And it was, you know, it was funny. It was facetious, but the Conan's team took it and ran with it and kind of put it on social media. And, you know, and really then behind the scenes, I ended up having a really fascinating dialogue with Conan and with a lot of members of his team too, with his producers and writers on the show, that was really, you know, about, again, what do white people need to be doing? What should people be reading? How could we be acting? What can we do differently? And I did get to go on and do this episode with him. But beyond that too, it also really opened up my, kind of my social media platform, and which got, a lot bigger than I was used to. And I have been using that to try to dialogue with white folks in particular, and answer people's questions and try to give some ideas and motivation and suggestions for how to be more effective. But the cool news is that this is actually, that Kamau and I have developed this whole thing into a book, and that's what he and I are working on right now. We are writing a book together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it began with that, and now we're turning it into a book. And so we're making, It's kind of like an it's kind of like an anti-racist workbook for adults. So it's the book that you're going to want to have as your companion to all the serious scholarly anti-racist books that everybody bought in June of 2020. And so it's going to have history. It's going to have anecdotes. It's and then it's got a bunch of activities like there's like word searches and crossword puzzles and quizzes, but they're all rooted in like real heavy stuff.
I can't wait for this.
So yeah, that's so
sounds amazing.
It's really fun to be working on.
That is so cool. Well, thank you so much, Kate. It was a joy to talk to you, and you're doing such great work in the world. So keep it up. I can't wait for more.
Oh, thank you so much, guys. Great to talk to you.
Good luck with this new book, too. Sounds fabulous.
Thank you. I'm going to go work on it right now while my kids are on their iPads.
Writing novels.
Yes, theoretically.
We'll be right back with today's book talk.
You know, a few weeks back, I mentioned that I was reading Tony Hoagland's poetry, and I was really captivated by it. And I feel like as a reader, sometimes I will have an excitement for an author, but I'll feel like I have to move on to a new book, and you know, whether it's something that's being celebrated in society or something like that, or just move on to know more about more authors. But I'm digging a little bit deeper into Tony Hoagland, and I'm reading a book that he wrote called The Art of Voice. So it's more of a craft book, but I'm reading it because voice, you know, this is like a question that so many writers ask is how do I develop my voice on the page? And it's such a tough question to answer. And I've heard so many people answer it in different ways. And so I thought it would be interesting just to do a deep dive into voice and really meditate on it. And so I'm going to read just a little bit from one of his opening paragraphs. Tony Hoagland says, "One way to make a convincing poetic voice is to display the mind in motion, or the mind changing direction as it speaks. We like to say I changed my mind, but the human mind alters its direction so rapidly and constantly, we might as well say my mind changed me. In a poem, this changing movement can be represented in many ways. It can be embodied through a kind of stuttering hesitation, or by a spontaneous uncensoredness, or as a deepening tangle of psychology. It can be formed as anxiety, or carefree lightheadedness, or as overconfident swagger, or a steady, painstaking thoughtfulness." That's all to say that, I'm going deep. I'm going to meditate on voice, and I'm going to meditate on my own voice and see what happens. See if I change my mind or my mind changes me.
Awesome, Grant. I'll look forward to hearing more about that. It sounds like we have a new episode on voice upcoming in the new year based on all of that. And so thanks, everyone. We're in December. It's pretty crazy. We're barreling toward the end of the year here. And you'll all remember that we had set a goal for ourselves to have something like 500 reviews, which we're definitely not going to attain. But you can help us inch a little bit closer. And, you know, the whole thing about setting goals that you try to reach. And then if you don't, we're just going to roll it over into the new year. So thank you for being with us. We appreciate it. And we'll see you next week.